Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I'm out of the office today, working remotely, you might say. Good thing I don't work at Yahoo, huh? The blowback has begun. We'll have that plus news of housing and that vacancy at the Vatican on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 26th of February. I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us. And we will begin today with a fairly stark declarative sentence. Home prices in the United States ended 2012 with their biggest gain in almost 7 years. What has come to be the standard measure of the health of the American housing industry, the Case-Shiller Home Price Index, jumped 6.8 in December over a year earlier. Gains in some cities in the double digits. A nifty report, to be sure, but one is obliged to wonder, in the face of numbers like these and with a history like ours, whether they might be too good for our own good. Marketplace's David Weinberg has more.
Every region has its own little ecosystem when it comes to housing. Prices in Texas and South Dakota, for example, are pretty flat compared to Phoenix in California, where prices are increasing at double-digit rates.
And that's largely driven by the fact that the banks are no longer selling homes.
Glenn Kelman is the CEO of the real estate brokerage Redfin.
It's mostly homeowners who have to do it, and they often just don't want to list at the bank's prices.
So they don't put their houses on the market either.
You know, we generally have 1,800 to 2,000 houses for sale in the Inland Empire. This morning, there's 346.
Bill O'Rafferty is a realtor in the Inland Empire in California. Yet another factor, hedge funds are buying up single-family homes in bulk there and in other hard-hit areas.
Absolutely. It's about 40% of our sales are to cash investors.
That is hedge funds. Throw in some super low interest rates for an added boost to demand, and you have price increases O'Rafferty hasn't seen since 93.
So that's why it doesn't surprise me that even though this is a very young housing recovery, I'm already hearing the bubble word.
Andrew LePage is an analyst at DataQuick. He says there are a couple things to consider before we start dropping the B word. One is that in many markets, prices are still below peak levels of 2005 and 2006.
And in many cases, sales are still below average.
Secondly, LePage says that if prices continue to increase, many of the people who are underwater will get pulled back onto dry land, and they, along with others who've been waiting, will finally put that for sale sign in the front yard. Supply will increase, which would make the risk of a bubble low. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
As we mentioned yesterday, changes are coming to Yahoo. CEO Marissa Myers got a new policy about working from home. Starting in June, there won't be any working from home. It's gotten quite a bit of reaction. The policy has pro and con.
But you do want people to be in the office because that's where meetings happen and that's where things do get done.
I think working from home is great to a certain degree. It allows me to see my kids for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Your employee is very efficient. The numbers are up. The dollars are rolling in. You should definitely. It should be part of an incentive plan to work from home.
Technology is all there to not do it. You can see someone face-to-face, talk, collaborate. So to me, it seems draconian to force staff to work in an office when it's absolutely supported not to.
What would you think if Daddy worked from home?
Okay, but I don't know.
Whether you think this is a good idea or you're one of the people who tweeted that the 1980s are calling and they want their workplace back, the truth is that Yahoo has taken a stand, one that a lot of people and companies are going to be watching, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
So I work from home sometimes. There's no commute and I can focus. But then I miss having people to bat around ideas with. Turns out my dilemma is also the employer's dilemma, says John Challenger, the CEO of outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas. When it comes to getting the most from workers, he says companies aren't doing enough telecommuting.
If it's productivity that's most important, then telecommuting seems to be a good idea.
But if you're looking for innovation and creativity, Challenger says it's better to keep teams together. That idea rings true for Hunter Walk, a former Googler. Until recently, he was a director of product management for YouTube.
A lot of new idea generation comes from sometimes people in the morning getting in a room, talking about an idea, then the engineers and designers going off and building something, and then coming back in a room to talk about a prototype.
And Yahoo isn't just any company, says Matt Marks, professor of entrepreneurship at MIT. They're at a crossroads. Especially if employees were abusing the ability to work from home, Mayer might have felt like she had to do something dramatic to jolt the company onto a new, more innovative path.
Because it's very hard to change a culture once it becomes acceptable or even, you know, commonplace for people to act in certain ways.
And maybe once the company's regained some of its former glory, then people can start working from home again. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Okay, stop me if you've heard this one before. Lawmakers in gridlock, the economy paralyzed, comedians in charge. Not, he says, with tongue in cheek, Washington, D.C., Rome, Italy. Instead, after the weekend's elections over there, a comedian, Beppe Grillo, now leads the largest party. Disgraced former Premier Silvio Berlusconi has somehow risen from his political grave, and the distinct possibility of fresh instability within the Eurozone looms. So, hey.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
Alessandro Valero works for a human rights group in Rome. Alessandro, it's good to talk to you.
Thank you.
So, quite a couple of days for you guys. What's the mood? How are you feeling?
Well, it's been very hectic and confusing days for everyone here in Italy. Once again, all the 200 polls of the last 6 months gave a solid win to the left-wing coalition. And then halfway through the afternoon yesterday, we got a completely different picture. Everyone is really confusing at the moment. We're in a completely stalemate, and nobody really knows what's likely to happen.
Well, I hate to ask, or I hate to pour salt on a wound, but it does now seem that there's a comedian here who could conceivably have a big role running the country.
Well, we are a nation of funny people, and once again, we've surprised the world with one buffoon who was, who actually had another job title to one whose real job title is that of a comedian.
You're talking about Mr. Berlusconi here, and now Beppe Grillo, right?
Yes, I am.
Does this now become a big problem for the rest of us with the European economy and Italy being thrown into, I guess you'd call it a crisis, right?
Well, Italy's been in a crisis for the last 10 years, a crisis that has been economic, as you know, because we hardly grew in the last 10 years. I think only Zimbabwe and Haiti have performed worse than us. It's basically been zero growth. It's an economic crisis. It's an institutional crisis, social crisis, because this country is undergoing massive poverty, as it's happening in Greece, from a country that enjoyed lots of wealth. And it's still the third economy of the Eurozone.
Yeah. Alessandro, I'm trying to figure out if you sound more disappointed or embarrassed or just disgusted.
It's a mix of all three. I'm embarrassed, I'm worried, because there's a whole generation that it's looking for a future, and it seems very difficult at the moment.
Well, Alessandro, thank you very much. Alessandro Valera in Rome, he works for a human rights group there. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Wall Street preferred the housing news over the Italy news, so the happy music is in store. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Don't know if you noticed, but we've made it, 9.5 minutes into the program without talking about the budget cuts that start to hit on Friday. Talk of debt and deficit drag on in Washington, in large part because of, or thanks to, depending on how you look at it, the efforts of one man, Pete Peterson, and his 35-year campaign that he financed himself to make debt. Topic number one. We put that debate into context for you yesterday. Today, Pete Peterson himself. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I wonder maybe if a place to start is with this fight we're having over the sequester now down in Washington. I wonder whether this is what you intended when you first started talking about the debt and deficit so many years ago, that we would get to this point.
Yes, the cliff discussions that took place at the end of last year and the discussions taking place now on sequester, as you probably know, those are focusing on the discretionary programs, not the long-term mandatory programs. I have believed that something along the lines of Simpson-Bowles, that's what you might call a grand bargain, is what we ought to be doing. A program that, for example, combines both revenue increases and spending cuts.
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying, because there will be Republicans who listen to this broadcast.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
You are saying that Republicans have to get their minds around the fact that taxes are going to have to go up.
I'm saying that a program like Simpson-Bowles that had about $3 of spending cuts for every dollar of revenue, and one that attacks all of the aspects of the budget in which everything is on the table, and by everything I mean entitlements, I mean tax reform, I mean defense, are all on the table, is the right way to approach this problem. And the Republicans taking the point of view that you can't raise taxes, and the Democrats taking the point of view that you can't reform entitlements, are ways of blocking meaningful progress.
And I appreciate that, sir, but there is the point to be made that the government can go out right now and borrow money for 10 years at 2%. Interest rates are practically zero. And yet all the warnings we've been hearing from you about the problems with long-term debt for the past 35 years have not yet come to pass.
I'm not against the government going out and borrowing some money as long as, A, that money is used for investment purposes, and, B, as long as you plan for the long term at the same time you're doing that. And this idea that we can't do both is an idea that I simply reject. That's all.
Well, and here's the thing I don't understand, Mr. Peterson. You keep saying long term. We have a long term problem. And I don't think anybody actually really disagrees with that. But the way it's been reflecting in Washington in the debate right now is short term. We have to cut right now. Is that smart?
That's why I think there is a significant shortcoming in the efforts in Washington today. I would be much happier with a program that was focused on the long term and, as I say, had some investment in the short term.
Are you satisfied we're ever going to get to that conversation, Mr. Peterson, that long term conversation, the way Washington is focused on what happens right now? Are you satisfied that we'll ever get to a long term conversation?
I'm going to keep working until we do. Because until we do, we are not talking about the underlying problem that confronts the long-term future.
Pete Peterson, the founder of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation. Mr. Peterson, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Okay, thank you for inviting me.
Coming up, talent for hire.
I am greatly impressed by the achievements of the Catholic Church and share many of its goals. I believe my qualifications and outlook make me a unique and interesting candidate for Pope.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials climbed 115 points today, about 0.8%, closed at 13,900. The NASDAQ added 13 points, 0.4%, 3,129 at the bell. The S&P 500 picked up 9.6%, finished at 1496. Good news on the housing front, not surprisingly, helped home builders. Shares of Pulte Group nailed an increase of 5.75%. Rival D.R. Horton hammered home a gain of more than 4%. Lennar added on 3.6% today. Staying with the housing theme, I mean, you know, why not, right? Home Depot posted better than expected earnings thanks partly to rebuilding from Hurricane Sandy. Shares rose 5.75%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.88%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for January. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly pending home sales index. It looks at housing contract activity for January. Also in the nation's capital, a dedication ceremony takes place for a statue of the late Rosa Parks. It will reside in the National Statuary Hall of the United States Capitol. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. We're not the only country trying to figure out what to do about immigration, you know. There are some concerns being raised over in the UK over the prospect of 250,000 Romanians and Bulgarians arriving. European Union rules give citizens of those two countries full access to a key EU right. That is the free movement of people starting next January the 1st. And with Britain on the brink of recession, that is not necessarily good news on the home front. From the European Desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
You're invited.
In its biggest ever ad campaign, drumming up business and tourism, the UK has been promoting itself around the world as Great Britain.
Memories are great. Countryside is great. Heritage is great.
You're invited.
But not if you're Romanian or Bulgarian. The British government's aghast that thousands of them could flood into Britain next year. The government's right to be fearful, claims Matthew Pollard of Migration Watch. Britain can't afford the influx.
We've got 2.5 million Brits unemployed. There's high youth unemployment.
And he says there's also an acute shortage of housing.
Especially in London and the South East, and there just isn't enough housing to go around.
Others fear the influx will bring a wave of welfare spongers, criminals and gypsies into Britain. A nightmare, a horror story will unfold.
Welcome, foolish mortals, to the Dracula experience.
This British exhibition reminds visitors that Dracula also hailed from what is now Romania, and he's the ultimate boogeyman. Cristina Irimir is a Romanian journalist who's lived in Britain for 7 years. She says the tabloids here and the government have been whipping up that primeval fear of foreigners.
Well, that's it, isn't it? I mean, migrants are the ones who are, you know, responsible that there's no jobs, the economy is poor. You know, they're just using migrants as a demon.
But the ruling Conservative Party was elected on a pledge to cut immigration. It's now casting around for a way of persuading Romanians and Bulgarians not to come to the UK. Another ad campaign has been proposed, telling them that they wouldn't like it here. That's going to be tricky.
Memories are great. Countryside is great. Heritage is great.
Especially when you've just been telling the world that Britain is a great place to visit and do business.
You see these amazing campaigns talking about the greatness of Britain, the greatness of British creativity, the greatness of British innovation.
Brand expert Faisal Siddiqui says it won't be easy for the government now to shift gear and pump out a negative message about the appalling weather, high unemployment and lack of opportunity in Britain.
To a certain extent, that detracts from that national narrative. I think it is very important to have a kind of narrative that does speak to the goodness of the country to create goodwill.
A positive image.
Absolutely.
The negative ads could backfire in another way. 40 years ago, when the Ugandan dictator Idi Amin expelled thousands of Asians, the people of Leicester in the English Midlands were terrified that some of the refugees would wind up in their city. So they took out an ad in Ugandan newspapers urging them not to come. 10,000, more than a third of the total, made a beeline for Leicester. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
As Congress and the White House try to figure out what's politically doable on gun control, there is some talk of limiting high-capacity magazines. And that, in turn, has turned at least part of the debate about guns to what goes in them. Joanna Pearlstein is a senior editor at Wired magazine. Her latest piece looks at the business of bullets. Joanna, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder if maybe we ought to start with a who's who, because you know when you're talking about guns, you know, everybody knows Winchester and Smith & Wesson and Ruger and all that. You're talking bullets, though. It's kind of a different deal, right?
It is and it isn't. There's about 10 billion bullets manufactured in the United States every year.
Wow.
I know. A fifth of those are made by the Freedom Group. That's a holding company that owns a lot of the names that you're familiar with, Remington, Barnes, Dakota Arms, and also Bushmaster. They made 2 billion bullets in 2011.
And if I wanted to go out and buy a box of, and I know this varies depending on size of shell and all of that stuff, but if I wanted to go out and buy some, you know, 22 caliber ammunition, how much am I going to pay for a box?
So you could go into a store and buy a box of 50 rounds of 9mm Luger,
yeah,
which is the most commonly sold kind of ammunition in the United States, for less than $20.
That's not a whole lot of money.
It's really not a whole lot of money. I mean, a lot of times you're talking per bullet less than a dollar.
And can I just walk in and buy a box of bullets? No permit, no nothing?
It really depends on where you are. There's three states in the United States plus Washington, D.C. that require you to have a license. Really, the regulations vary considerably. The main thing that our federal regulations are about who you are. So if you are not in the United States legally, you can't buy ammunition. If you were dishonorably discharged from the military, if you have certain felony convictions, if you're under the age of 18, you cannot purchase ammunition. That said, there's not a lot of background checks that are being done. So the onus is on you as the purchaser to basically be honest when you go into a store and buy ammunition.
As you guys were reporting this out, how hard was it to find out what you found out?
It was really pretty difficult. I expected to be able to find out, for example, what are the most popular kinds of bullets sold in the United States. But when I asked that question of the National Shooting Sports Foundation, mm-hmm, which is the industry association for firearms, they don't really want to tell you. And similarly, I also wanted to know what the most commonly used kinds of ammunition were recovered at crime scenes. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has a system called NIBIN. That stands for the National Integrated Ballistic Information Network. And they collect cartridges that are retrieved at crime scenes and put them into a big database. So I asked them for that information, and they told me to file a FOIA request.
Wow, really?
Yeah, exactly.
And so did you?
I did. And if I get anything back from them, I'll let you know.
We'll call you
back.
I want to play a piece of tape for you now. It's Chris Rock. I'm sure you've heard it before.
Yes.
But it's pretty good. Talking about bullets and the pricing thereof. Here we go.
You don't need no gun control. You know what you need? We need some bullet control. I think all bullets should cost $5,000. You know why? Because if a bullet costs $5,000, there'll be no more innocent bystanders.
So it's pretty funny, right? But it's not necessarily wrong. You know, we tax tobacco, we tax alcohol special. I mean, is there talk of a bullet tax?
I haven't heard a lot of talk of a bullet tax, but you can really see why it would be a good idea. You know, cigarettes, as you mentioned, are a great example of that. As cigarette taxes have increased over the years, consumption of cigarettes has declined. The tobacco industry has been up in arms about this for years. It stands to reason that if, as we discussed earlier, you can buy a box of 50 bullets for $20, maybe if that box costs $40 or $80 or, you know,
or $10,000,
maybe we would be buying fewer of them.
Joanna Pearlstein, she's a senior editor at Wired. They've got kind of an awesome infographic about ammunition, the business, and the industry of making bullets. Joanna, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me.
Papal conclave assembles in a couple of weeks, and while many believe the successor to the current pope should be a cardinal with some experience, there is at least one man out there who feels he's got what it takes to lead the Catholic Church. Here with his cover letter.
Dear Sir or Madam, I am writing to apply for the position of pope. I recently received my Bachelor of Arts, or Artium Baccalaureus, from Dartmouth College with a major concentration in theater studies and a minor in computer science. While I have been focusing on the technology and financial sectors, I have recently decided to widen my job search to include top nonprofits, such as your organization. I am greatly impressed by the achievements of the Catholic Church and share many of its goals. I believe my qualifications and outlook make me a unique and interesting candidate for Pope. Over the past 4 years, I have worked tirelessly to receive the kind of well-rounded education that is indispensable to today's leaders, whether in the boardroom, the operating room, or the Vatican. My thesis project, a musical King Lear that took place entirely on Facebook, integrated my chosen areas of study, including advanced Shakespeare, social media, and 20th century Latin jazz. As social chair of my fraternity, I not only increased the attendance of our weekly no-pants parties by 30%, I also convinced the disciplinary council to permit Alpha Chi Alpha to conduct internal reviews of alleged incidents of sexual harassment and bullying. I am a problem solver. While I have never studied Catholicism per se, I have several credits in the world religions, and as the intern supervisor at the prominent Oakland law firm of Russ, Davies, and Chalmers will confirm, I am a quick study. Additionally, I have noted your organization's expanding client base in South America. This is an area in which I am well-versed after spending an entire semester in Buenos Aires, where I became intimately acquainted with the people, their food, and their culture. As an excellent student with advanced people skills and an exciting resume, with a desire to be part of a challenging, energetic, and reputable organization, I will be a valuable addition to the Catholic Church as your new pope. While I am focusing my employment search in the San Francisco Bay Area, I am open to a discussion of relocation. I thank you in advance for your consideration. John Ortved.
John Ortved is a contributor to McSweeney's. His work appears in The New Yorker and Vanity Fair as well. You can find this and all of our other commentaries online. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, we did a thing a couple of months ago about beer and how you can tell a lot about a person's politics by the beverage they choose. Well, today, the non-alcoholic version. The polling group Public Policy Polling has some new data out. Democrats apparently choose regular sodas over diet 47% to 31%. Republicans go 42% for diet, 34% for regular. Coke beats Pepsi no matter how you vote, and soda beats beer, which honestly just beats me, man. I don't know. All right, and with that, we are done. That's Marketplace from APM. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.